little closer to the regular time on the clock. But remember, from Sunday, I still have 1 minute extra somewhere. You're looking at these, so we might as well just answer these. We usually jump right on into the class and then come back around to these questions, but there's really only one question on there. I ask you to do a little bit of reading. We're going to come back and read together verse 3 through 12. But if you look down at verse 5, 9, and 10, can you find a common word in there? Ands and A's and things don't count, right? What's a common word? Salvation. Is that what y'all see? Yes. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight is going to have to do with salvation. We're going to have one very long chart. We're going to walk through and see what all of these verses have to say about salvation. So that should kind of tip us off. That's the theme of a lot of what we'll talk about. Here's the title of our study. We're going to try to get through 1st and 2nd Peter and the book of Jude. I've told you my role is really an introductory role, although we will kind of put our toes a little bit into the water. We'll get into 1 Peter chapter 1 tonight, but other than that, my other responsibility will be to introduce 2 Peter, just like we introduced 1 Peter on Sunday morning. The other classes, Philip will be teaching for us. There is material back on the foyer for lessons 3 through the rest of 1 Peter. I think it's probably about lesson 7 or so. I can't remember. So there's a lot of material out there. Hopefully soon we'll figure out how to combine some things and get it onto the website, at least through 1 Peter. So if that's your means of accessing those lessons, you can get through. All right, here we are. This is our schedule. As I said, you know, my role is mostly introductory. But tonight we are going to go through the first 12 verses of 1 Peter chapter 1. And continue on through our 13 lessons here. Notice, I don't remember if I said this Sunday morning or not, but Vacation Bible School is coming up next week. And because it's difficult to disturb those classrooms, we always do something special in here. So we won't have a class on 1st and 2nd Peter and Jude next Wednesday. But this chart will kind of help you understand where we're going in various dates. All right, let's look at our goals. You might remember how we described them overall. What would be a good adjective for the goals that we are setting for this class?
Hard to reach.
Hard to reach. That's a good one. Except that's not one word, right? Hard to reach, yeah. Okay. Yeah, at least give us some chance of getting there. Not all the way to impossible. Lofty. That's good. I like that. I used the word ambitious. Lofty is a good one too, though. These are goals that are not going to be easy to do, but I think they're very worthy of us. And I mentioned to you that Philip had helped to come up with pretty much all five of these in the wording, even with them. But notice this, first of all, the goal of developing a reputation for good works among those who might be the most critical of our faith. Now, you might be thinking, nobody's criticizing me for my faith. Nobody's making a big deal about it. And that can very well be the case. But I'm sure you know people that if they knew everything that you believe, they wouldn't agree with all that you believe. And those are the individuals you should be thinking of. What kind of things am I doing in front of them that speak to my faith? How do I act in a difficult circumstance? How do I treat them when they're looking for help and need some? What am I doing that would be seen by them that would fit, would show them the kind of faith they have? And if you think about 1 Peter chapter 2, this is coming out of that. It's one of those goals. The second thing is, by the time we get through all of this study, we would like to be able to promote more or greater harmony within our families. We all have a role. We're either fathers or mothers or husbands or wives or sons or daughters or brothers or sisters. There's somewhere in there where we have a role within our families. And what is that role? And 1 Peter 3 talks a lot about that. But we also said we'd like to expand this goal. Not that we're not lofty enough. Let's expand it a little bit more and include our role within the family here. What's your place? And how can you promote the kind of harmony? There's some really interesting passages in here about everybody having the same mind of humility and unity. And we want to think about how we can fit in regard to that, our place. Deepen the relationship with the shepherds. I'm looking forward to sitting down and let Philip explain this goal. As I said before, it sounds a little self-serving as one of the shepherds, elders here, to say, what I'd like for you to do, let's all set a goal of getting a better relationship with me. That would be good. That's not what we're looking for. In fact, beyond just the elders here, what are we really thinking of when we say a relationship with the shepherds? The chief shepherd, right? And we want to start from that. But it would not be a bad idea at all for you to think about one of the four elders and that you would like to know better than that you know today. If 6.5 weeks from now or 6 weeks from now, you could say you've developed a deeper relationship with one of the elders, that goal would be accomplished here and would be a good thing. Deepen our appreciation for the suffering of Christ and what it means for us to share in that suffering. This evening, I think we will hit on some things in these first few verses that will speak to that goal. We're not going to have much to say about those first three out of the passages we'll cover tonight, but that one and the fifth one, to invest in things that last the longest, we will definitely talk about where we're headed, what really matters, what's valuable for us, and the reason why we were born again, what are we going to get as a result of that. Those are the things that last and things that we need to put time and effort and thought into. And so I think that both the fourth and the fifth goal will come out of that. All right, I'm batting 2-for-2 because I remembered again to stop and have a word of prayer, which usually by this point I've completely forgotten. But Jason, if you don't mind leading us in prayer, I'd appreciate it. All right, just very quickly, let's go back. I know a lot of you weren't here. We'll just run through some things that speak to the book, kind of an introductory things. As you know, Peter wrote the letter. It starts immediately with that, him identifying himself as an apostle of Christ. We'll go back and we'll look at some of the relationship things that they enjoyed. It's addressed to the pilgrims of the dispersion. But it depends on your translation, right? What other words do you have besides pilgrims? I didn't hear that. Strangers. Aliens. Exiles. You can get a lot of different words here that have to do with someone who is a citizen somewhere else other than the place where they're currently residing. And so we're talking about individuals who are in these places. We'll look at where Pontus, Galatia, and so forth are in just a moment. But they don't really belong there, because they're citizens of Christ, and there's some tension between them and the world, and that'll come up as we look at some of the persecution that's going on at that time. Just to go back, I don't want to go back through these passages, but I think it's interesting. Trying to decide, is a letter written primarily just to those that are Jews? The idea of a dispersion, a lot of reasons for that to be a reference to the Jewish people who had been dispersed from their homeland of Judea and the Promised Land and all. But there are other things in this letter that would seem to indicate that those who were receiving it would have also come out of a Gentile background. ideas about their forefathers being in ignorance and such. It usually references more to those that were of the Gentile background. However, these are the places here. Let's see those circles on there. What's all of these circles are in what present-day country? Turkey. And, you know, you can see that a lot of it are in places where you don't have so much the journeys of Paul, somewhat, but not really all the way up to Pontus and so forth. These are names that come up, but we don't know quite as much about them as we know some of the other places. But there in the yellow is where the seven churches that were addressed in the book of Revelation. And so that also is an area, that would have been that area known as Asia. And so these are the five places or areas where the letter's going out and would be useful for other Christians as well. It was written from Babylon. You see a little question mark there. What do you think it means, literal or figurative? What would be the literal Babylon? It should be easy. You just say the city of Babylon. I mean, that there was a city of Babylon. It was the famous great power that was took away the southern part of the nation of Israel, the two southern tribes. But that city had kind of faded in many ways, but he could have been writing from some area over there. What might be the figurative Babylon? Where else do you read about Babylon in the Bible besides the literal Babylon? In the book of Revelation, and many people identify that with the city of Rome. Peter have been there. It's hard to say. It's not really that important where he wrote this from, but when he did write it, he has a couple of names at the end of the letter that he mentions. He mentions Mark, who's with him. He also mentions Silvanus, who may even have been the one given some credit related to it because perhaps he was the messenger of it. But I wanted to show something we didn't. Everything we just talked about, if you were not here on Sunday, you're kind of caught up to some degree. But this is a slide we didn't talk to on Sunday morning, and I think it's important. It has to do with the nature of the persecution that was going on. You can think about it in a couple of ways. You can think about 1 Peter as introducing the idea that these individuals are being persecuted for their... Well, I don't want to tell you what they're persecuted for. We'll look at that in a second. Then in 2 Peter, the danger is that they'll just give up. You know, if I'm being oppressed because I'm trying to follow Christ, then maybe the best thing to do is to just quit and live like everybody else lives. And a lot of 2 Peter has to do with that giving in to the world. Well, look at these passages here. I hope you have your Bible opened up to 1 Peter, and we'll look at some of these things. These were the things that were happening. Some people were calling them strange. They were being spoken against as if the things that they did were evil. In chapter 3, in verse 16, even their good manner of life was being reviled, and again you have this phrase that they were being spoken against. Verse 16, let's read that. Having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. Remember, that was part of our theme verse last year, looking at that and thinking through why that was the case. Look at chapter 2 and verse 12. This is interesting. This has to do with one of our goals about how we will live among those that might oppose our faith. And in verse 12, let's get a reader. Jason, how about reading for us, please, Mr. McElvain? Verse 12 of chapter 2. Okay, so here's the hope that some of this might turn around and might change at some points. Reason why we've set the goal of the kind of good works we do, among others. But what were they doing first? Before they had a good opinion about those Christians, what were they first doing? They were speaking against them. Again, whatever they were doing was being viewed in that way. And back to chapter 4 again, you have them being reproached here in connection with the fact that they were Christians. Verse 13 says, "Rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when His glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed." You see the nature of how they were being persecuted? It's not the fact that, well, I'll show you this, and I'll wait a minute. I'll wait. There's another slide here. But I do want you to look at why they might have been persecuted this way, being spoken against. Even though they may have done good things, they were being spoken against. A lot of it has to do with, were they living like everybody else? Can you think of a passage in 1 Peter 3 where it specifically says you're not acting like everybody else and it's bothering them? Or they're taking note of your different behavior? Okay, look at chapter 4 and verse 4. It says, with respect to this, they are surprised when you did not join them in the same flood of debauchery and they malign you. You're not living like we are. What's wrong with you? Why are you not doing those things? And they maligned those Christians because they were not living in the same manner as them. There's also this interesting passage back in chapter 2, in verse 16, where he says, live as people who are free. Christians should think of themselves as free. It doesn't mean you conduct yourself any way you want to, but it does kind of speak to a freedom from fear, doesn't it? You know that you belong to the Lord. You're able to live in a different way. It's interesting, in chapter 3, when he's speaking to the wives, he talks to them about the way that they could follow Sarah and her behavior. And in the end part of verse 6, he says, if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening, you're not afraid. The world doesn't really like that. They don't like it when people don't conform. They don't seem to be fearful of the things that everybody else is fearful of. That being different is something that sometimes is bothersome. And of course, a lot of what they would have believed would have just been completely opposed to the belief of other people. And as a result, you have this kind of persecution here. So here's a theme of 1 Peter. It has to do with being able to endure the trials and the suffering that they're going through, which, in parentheses I added, this is why we're calling the 1 Peter portion of our study standing firm. Having enough courage to stand firm despite the kind of persecution. But look at this. The word suffer is in this letter 16 times. And I'll just go ahead and show you that the word glory is used 15 times. So if we can think of those two things combined, and they will come back to what we're going to look at in a minute here in chapter 1 in those first 12 verses. 16 times suffer is mentioned. But I think this definition is right. This has to do with pain or grief inflicted by those around them as a result of doing right or living godly. What are some other ways you can suffer besides suffering for doing something good? Give me an example of how you might suffer. Okay, you might do something that's wrong and get punished for it. You know, you break a law, you have to suffer as a result of it. You break the laws of nature, you have to suffer in some way because of that. Other ways that we end up suffering in life? Bill? Just our own personal foolishness will lead to problems for us. Sometimes it has nothing to do with us though, right? It could be disease, it could be problems, it could be inherited things, it could be issues that others that we care about are going through, and we could suffer as a result of those kinds of problems. That's not really what 1 Peter is primarily about when it's talking about suffering. It's talking about suffering because you're doing the right thing and the consequences of doing the right thing and the pressure that you will feel from other people when you're trying to do what's right and they're opposing you. But then you have this word glory. And it shows up. And I hope you'll notice, even as we begin our study into the first few verses of chapter 1, many times the word glory is going to come up. But there's three ways to think about the word glory. And the first two have to do with who is being glorified. Who does the book letter, do you think, talks about being glorified? Who could these two be? Katie? Well, God, well, and I understand you're saying God and Christ. I would put that as one, okay? The God, those the ones that are divine, There's God's glory, the glory of Christ. And it's something that God possesses. But He is also to be glorified and given the honor that He deserves. But who else is going to be glorified? Who else is spoken of as being glorified in this letter? Back here? The followers of Christ. We're going to be glorified. And in fact, He starts the letter off with that idea of the glory that we have and are going to have. And that glory is the glory that comes from God as well. It's something He's going to provide to us, that sort of honor. Not really the honor that we deserve. We're going to see it connected with mercy and with grace, but nevertheless, there is glory to be received from God. So these are some themes out of 1 Peter. But I want to ask you a couple things about Peter, and so you feel him again, as we talked about Sunday morning. He's written this letter, but I want you to think of him as a real person and feel him writing out this letter and his emotions and his heart as he pours them into this letter to those groups that are in these five places. First of all, did he witness the suffering of Christ? Where? Where can you think of him seeing it, watching it? In the garden. He was close enough there to see it, and each time Christ came, woke him back up, he could see the kind of suffering he'd been going through. Where else did he see him suffer and be persecuted? James. He was able to get close enough to the trial to watch what was taking place there and to see himself. And I suspect that he somehow was a witness enough to the cross or knew enough about it. We know John was there. We don't know for sure that Peter was. But clearly, Peter understood the suffering of Christ. Not only that, did he suffer as a Christian? Did he experience persecution? Can you give me an example of that? We looked through some things in his life on Sunday morning, those of you that were here. What are some things that happened to him as a Christian? He was beaten, he was arrested. Somebody mentioned on Sunday him nearly being put to death, or at least they were going to. He was in prison, it was about to take place, and he's freed by the angel there. But did he ever fail? When he had to face these kinds of trials, somebody put the pressure on Peter, did he ever fall? The whole idea of the denial. You remember what he was denying? That he even knew Christ. You know, if anyone suffers as a Christian, oh, you're a Christian, not me, not me. I don't even know that man. I have nothing to do with him. That's the kind of failure that he'd gone through. Do you think that comes through some way in his writing of sympathy and understanding when he writes to others to urge them to stay firm, to hang on, to endure that kind of persecution, knowing that, you know, it is hard at times. He's failed himself. But did he also persevere? In the end, he really does. You're right, Chester. And I'm going to show you a verse for that in just a minute. And he certainly witnessed Christ being glorified. He watched him being raised back to heaven. I'm going to skip over those dates here, but I want to show you this in 1 Peter. Not this one. I want to go ahead to this. This is a portrait of Peter. In this first chapter here, one of the things he's going to talk about is hope. And one interesting thing that you can do throughout the letter of 1 Peter in particular is you can look at some of the things that Peter chooses to write about and see something that happened back in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John that relates back to his own experiences with Christ. And what I think is interesting in this first chapter is he's going to talk about hope. But look at this moment when he was sort of hopeless. He had denied Christ, saying to the woman, I do not even know him. And then after Jesus kind of looks back across and he realizes what's happening there, Peter went out and he wept bitterly. And it's meant a lot to me over the years to think about this. If that's happening on a Friday, early morning hours of Friday, how do you think Peter felt Friday night when Jesus is dead? And Saturday? And into Sunday morning? What kind of man was Peter? How did he feel? What kind of hope did he have? I mean, his life is just devastated. And he doesn't know. We know the rest of the story. It's like, oh, what's the big deal? You know, 2 days of despair, that's no big deal. He had no idea that Christ was going to be raised from the dead. He could have. There have been some predictions of that, but he didn't believe that. He's despairing. And yet, he writes this in 1 Peter 1, verse 3, that Christ has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Christ from the dead. You think he felt that? You think the day that he saw Jesus alive, on that Sunday, and apparently he appeared just to Peter. That's kind of the reports that come back toward the end of the book of Luke. How do you think he felt when there was Christ, and all that despair goes away, and all that chance to tell him how sorry he was? You know, what an opportunity. That's Peter as he's writing this letter. Okay. Any questions or comments at this point? Because we're going to... This is our last slide, but it gets a little complicated as we go through this. Yes, sir, Nathan. Right. Sure. Yeah, that's good. And Nathan was mentioning a couple of other ways that Peter's experience would speak to this kind of persecution. You have things like in John chapter 6, where so many of his own disciples had stopped following him because his teachings were so hard and confusing and people didn't want to. Those you would think would be on his side, the very leaders of the country, are against him. And so you have that sense of those we ought to be able to hold in high respect and honor are actually also opposing him. Whose side am I on? Now I don't feel like I'm part of my own culture because they're the ones who are opposing him. Yeah, he had that kind of experience, and it would help him be able to relate to others who are going to experience that, and to us who have some of those same issues that we have to face as we go through life. Joe, you're in the back. I'm hoping you'll be willing to read verse 3 through 12 of 1 Peter 1, because I think we can hear you better speaking up from the back, if you don't mind. Yes, please. One more verse. Go to verse 12. Okay, this is in some ways a relatively easy section. If you take any one verse along the way, it talks about things that I think for the most part we're relatively familiar with. But when you take the whole reading and you listen through that, it's a little difficult to follow the full flow of thought that he's trying to give here. And I think it has to do with time. That what he's talking about are things that have to do with now. Did you hear the word now a couple of times? Depending on your translation. He's speaking of things that are happening in that very day. In this you rejoice, verse 6, though now for a little while. Does he talk about the future? Like how? What? Give me an example. What does he say about the future? What's out there? That will come to you. In what? What's coming? If there's this ultimate salvation that he's talking about. That's on ahead. And things that are reserved for us in heaven. Those aren't now. That's something out there in the future. But does he talk about the past? I mean, besides now, I'm saved, here I am now, I'm looking forward to heaven. But does he talk about people or things in the past? The prophets. So we got all these time things here. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of walk through this great salvation and think about it in terms of time. Let's start with verse 3. So wherever you see a line there, it will tell you that that's a beginning point and we'll move across to a period of time. So our starting point here is being born again. Look at verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to His great mercy, we want to be sure we understand how we have been born again. He has caused us to be born again to a living hope. We'll come back to that living hope in just a moment. So, here you are as a child of God. This is your life in Christ began at some moment in time when you were baptized into Christ. Through repentance and your faith, your sins have been washed away. You've now started a life. What might that life be like? Well, for those that Peter was writing to, he says, well, now, for a little while, here's what things are like. So look down at verse 6, and maybe some other things that you see in there. What was their life like? You see anything that describes their life, at least in verse 6? Right, there's some trials, there's some difficulties. The kind of persecution we've been talking about, there's some things that are happening there. Let's just list a number of things. First of all, part of what's happening now is that we have a living hope. Peter could say that. He understood that. He had seen Jesus raised from the dead. He witnessed Him. He knew that Christ, if He was raised from the dead, Peter also is going to be raised from the dead. So there's this living hope. That should characterize our life now, is that we are people of hope, a living hope. In verse 5, though, he says that we are guarded. And I wish that didn't all come up. It gives you half of the answer I wanted here. There's really two things he says that we are guarded by. You see those two things in verse 5? By God's power, but also by our faith. He says that who by God's power you're being guarded. This is what's happening as part of right now for this little while through faith, but by God's power. That you could overlook that verse. And I think about how significant that is. He is saying that in this life, you're responsible for your salvation, but so is God. And sometimes we get all confused about that. You know, who's really causing this to happen? We can't get credit for it, but we are involved in it. We need to have faith, and we need to be living by that faith. But at the same time, we're being guarded by God's power during these days here. But as was pointed out, Marissa mentioned this in verse 6, you can see this grief that's taking place. There's some trials. Not everything in this life, despite our living hope, despite our faith, not everything is going to be the way that we would like for it to be. So he says in verse 6, he mentions these various trials that you have and that your faith is being tested. And so a lot of this letter is about trying to get people to be able to survive that test and to stand firm all the way through that to the end. And then he says here, you're also loving and believing in Jesus. What's the contrast, though, here in verse 8 that Peter makes about himself and about others? He really doesn't. I'm sorry, he doesn't make it about himself, but if you think about it for a moment, you know that. What does he say about them in regard to Christ? You haven't seen him. So you can't really understand him. Is that his point? No. You haven't seen him. But even though you haven't seen him, what do? Love him. Because there's enough reason to believe that he really is the Son of God. And to have love for him because of what we know that he has done. Do you feel a little greater comfort when you read something like that, knowing it's being written by somebody who actually did see Jesus raised from the dead? That's why it's so important to keep in mind who's writing this letter, because that helps us a great deal in that regard. And he says this about us. Besides our love and believing in Jesus, there's two things about our life right now. We are full of joy inexpressible, unspeakable. Or are we? That's a challenge sometimes. And I've been trying to think back about the idea of grace and how that all these gifts and all the kinds of things he's talking about in this passage are the kinds of things that you have to dwell on if you're really going to end up with joy inexpressible. Otherwise, well, look at the contrast. Even here, this is the life right now, right? What's the contrast with joy? Yeah, the trials, but the word. What could result? Grief. Grief and joy. That does that characterize our life in this way? Absolutely. We have both. There are times in which the trials are grievous. But our living hope allows us still to have a joy that you sometimes can't even fully express. But it's there. And we also have this glory. There's another place where that word comes up. So, here we are. Here's the end point, though. Now, we're born again, but one day, the real thing is coming. When Christ is revealed again. So look down at verse 7 here in this passage. The tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it's tested by fire, may be found to result in praise, glory, and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ, His coming again. And there are a lot of things said about after He comes again. That's the last time. Here's some things He has to say about that. Back up to verse 4. These are also those things that lead to this joy inexpressible. He says, when you are born again, you received an inheritance. So there's like something coming out there for you. It's an odd kind of inheritance. It's the kind of inheritance you get after you die or after Christ comes again, as opposed to somebody else. But it's yours. You can count on this inheritance. And the way he describes it, the things that are reserved, kept for us up in heaven, imperishable, undefiled, fades not away. How would that contrast to those that are being persecuted? What might happen to their possessions? You know, yeah, it could be. The Hebrew account talks about a persecution, probably like what some of these that received this letter have gone through or are going to go through, and their possessions were taken away. But they had this to look forward to, these things that were never going to go away. And so that's the description given of that. He also talks about it as being a salvation that's revealed. The end of our faith, the end result of it, he's talking about in verse 9, that you will receive, which of course is the salvation of your souls. So what we've got across this bottom part of this is this is our life as a Christian. We're born again, but for a little while, things are going to be wonderful in terms of what we can look forward to, our hope, our expectation, but there'll be difficult times as well. And he's asking us to hang on through those so that eventually we can get what really lasts. That's why we talk about making an investment in the things that really last. But if I could double that slide up there, if I could like move that one over to the right, you know, put another screen up to the left and move backwards in time, because we said he's talking about now and he's talking about the future, but what else is he talking about? The past. I can't really do that. But we can kind of jump up on top and say, okay, well, here's the past. before we get to that born again part. Some things happen beforehand. And you begin to see the plan of God and the purpose. And I think one of the reasons why that's so valuable to us is we get caught up in the things that are happening in our life right now, and we wonder, is this really real? Does this matter? Is my faith really on a solid rock? But when you begin to see how it's connected back to things God did for thousands of years, that's helpful. It puts your faith in a more permanent place and on top of a stronger foundation. And he talks about those prophets before who were looking. Remember in this passage, it was talking about those who were wondering, what am I writing about? Who's going to be the benefactors of these things I'm writing about? And who was it? Who are the benefactors? We are. And those to whom Peter was writing at that time. They were the benefactors of those things. But they were predicting Christ being manifested. So in the past, a time came when Jesus came to this world. And in verse 20, so we're kind of jumping a little bit ahead of some things that took place in the past, some of the things they predicted. Look at verse 20. He, Christ, was foreknown before the foundation of the world. This is part of God's plan. Even for history of man, he already had this plan. That Christ would come and would be glorified. But now, he says, back to verse 12, we're back to another place where it says now, it was revealed to them, they're not serving themselves, but you in the things that have now been announced to you. And the things that have been announced are not the things that the prophets wrote. Who's announcing those things in verse 12? The Spirit is guiding men to do it. So you're good to give credit there. The preachers, the Peters, the others that are out there telling about Christ now are the ones who are actively mentioning, talking about Christ, and that's what he mentions in verse 12. And they're announcing to you in the gospel by the things they preach and sent by the Holy Spirit. You know what those things do? They help you to be born again. And the arrow's meant to kind of, again, if I could, you just put all that stuff at the top over there to the left and we'd move ahead. How do you get born again? What do you need to have? You got to have faith, but how do you get faith? By the Word. You got to hear the Word. You got to know about Christ. And you see, it's interesting, while any one of those verses in those first 12 or so there, by themselves, I really don't think they're that difficult to understand, but it's really hard to catch the flow of thought. But what he's done is he's described this great salvation over the whole time span. And if you go out to verse 20, from before the time the world was created all the way up to when it's all over and Christ is revealed again. But what matters the most, I think, to you and me is that time period between when we decide to obey the gospel and we're born again and the time when we ultimately get the inheritance that's going to be ours. There are going to be things that are going to fight us between there. And 1 Peter is about how you can endure that and stand firm and be ready. Any questions about that section? We didn't maybe get into as much detail as you might have liked, but hopefully this chart will help to illustrate some of it. Yes, sir. Ron. I'm tempted to turn to the co-teacher of the class and say, but better yet, the bell rescues me out of that. No, I think of words like that as probably meaning more of allowed to. It caused it. It produced it. But not necessarily in the forcing, made it happen kind of manner. But I don't know that word that well to say that. There are lesson sheets back there. One thing I meant to do, and hopefully I'll do my best to remember, is to print out copies of the goals. The class. You can have a separate copy of those because I do want you to be thinking and working through those as we go through our study. Thanks for your attention tonight.